tonight on Arena. In telly, we look at Paradise, Prime Target and Brian and Maggie. And we have new albums from FKA Twigs, Mogwai and Sam Amadon up for review. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can get us on socials at RTE Arena. And you can watch us if you're lucky enough to have access to the internet and all that is necessary for that on rte.ie/arena. And I would absolutely echo the words of Cormac O'Hara to those of you who are listening to us on battery operated transistor radios at the moment. We hope that things get back to normal for you fairly soon. Obviously things will eventually, but it may take some time. And if it's your first time here with us at 7 o'clock on a Friday, don't be a stranger. You can come back even when the electricity and everything is back. But do stay safe, and hopefully you'll all be back in action before too long. Now, Prime Target on Apple TV is a new series about our postgraduate mathematics student who discovers that someone is trying to destroy his work in finding a pattern in prime numbers that would allow him to access every computer in the world. Paradise is new to Disney Plus. The series is set in a serene community inhabited by some of the world's most prominent individuals. This piece is shattered when a murder takes place and a high-stakes investigation gets underway involving a Secret Service agent, Xavier Collins, played by Sterling K. Brown, who is the chief security officer of a former president, Cal Bradford, played by James Morden. The series was created by Dan Fogelman, who brought us This Is Us and much else besides. And Brian and Maggie is a Channel 4 dramatisation of the infamous 1989 interview between the journalist Brian Walden and the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Margaret Thatcher. The fallout from that interview, many would argue, triggered the downfall of the Iron Lady. This two-part series is directed by Steve Frears, stars Steve Coogan as the aforementioned journalist, Brian Walden, and Harriet Walter as Margaret Thatcher. And we will be previewing that, as it's not allowed to be reviewed just yet. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched all three series and they're with me in the studio right now. Let us start with Paradise. Is Paradise we're starting with? Is it? Yes, I think it is. Psychological thriller starring Sterling K. Brown, James Marsden and Julianne Nicholson, set in the peaceful, idyllic community which is home to many influential people from around the world, and follows the aftermath of a shocking murder and the ensuing investigation, which brings deeply buried secrets to light. Did I say Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon were with me in studio? They are with me in studio. On the surface, certainly at the outset of this one, Chris, I kind of thought, yeah, lonely ex-Secret Service agent, having difficulties with his two kids, no sign of his wife anywhere, we don't know why. And he's looking after somebody important.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I've seen this more than once before.
Yeah, and I think Dan Fogelman and his team know that you've seen this once or twice before, which is why at some point in the series, we won't give it away.
It becomes
about more than just, you know, a presidential assassination, if you can imagine a storyline bigger than that. But it's the cast that we're here for, and it's the cast that kind of keep us watching, even when the plot gets a little too outlandish. So you have Sterling K. Brown reuniting with Dan Fogelman because, you know, the two of them scored a huge hit with This Is Us. And he is the Secret Service guy you mentioned, Xavier Collins. And he is living in this ideal serene community where there is no mother around, but he has two kids. And we won't get into what happened with that relationship. But he's not a happy man. He seems like a bit of a stress man. You know, the camera shows us that there are some scars here. So maybe he took a hit for his boss on one other occasion. But he thinks that he's waking up, you know, for just another day of, you know, looking after the boss. He thinks that this is just going to be, you know, nine home of five. Unfortunately, and this is not a spoiler, this is all over the trailer, it's all over the marketing materials, he shows up at work to find that the president of the USA has
died. And this
died.
Is in the first 5
this
minutes.
This is absolutely in the first 5 minutes, yes.
Put him in there quicker, I have to say.
Yeah, that's
didn't
true.
Need to take that long.
That's true, and clearly this president, Cal Bradford, played by James Marsden, has not died of under natural circumstances. Something has happened to him, and it doesn't help that he was the last person to see him.
The Sterling K. Brown character was the last person to see him.
That's it, yeah. And all the footage shows us that, you know, like, that he, again, he was the last to see him.
And then, so that's the kind of the present moment of the series. And then I thought, oh, here we go, flashbacks. And it's full of flashbacks because they were hardly going to have James Marsden in it for 2 minutes at the top and then have him executed. So let's have him, or assassinated. Let's have him offering the job, the moment when Marsden offers the job to Sterling K. Brown's character.
Why the change, sir? I know Agent Monroe. He's as good as it gets.
He's a bore. And he's old. If my lead agent isn't going to be fun to be around, I'd like to at least know he can lift heavy stuff. Look, I'm looking for someone to be by my side for the next 4 years and potentially into my pool float years. As you know, they let us keep light protection even after we leave the big house. They gave me a list and a batch of names. I looked at that list and batch of names. I asked to meet with you. Why, sir? Why did you ask to meet with me? That's a great question, Agent Collins. I'm so happy you asked. I promise this is not a regular thing. Well, in answer to the question that you didn't ask, I hear you're the best of the best. I feel pretty confident you can lift heavy stuff, and it doesn't hurt that you're black. I'm supposed to be a Southern progressive, but I got a bunch of white guys surrounding me everywhere I go.
So I'm here because I'm black.
You're here because you're good. And the other guy was boring and old. It just doesn't hurt that you're black. Does my directness bother you?
No, sir. But... no, sir.
There was a but.
I just wonder if having a black man guarding you is really the progressive visual you think it is.
Sterling K. Brown there as Agent Xavier Collins and James Marsden as the president. Jen Gannon, a lovely relationship kind of develops between the two. When you hear the talk about race and colour in that opening scene, I kind of was going, where is this heading?
It is interesting, and I think it all kind of hinges on the charm of Marsden, of James Marsden, and the charisma of him, because he is playing, like he says, that Southern progressive, that, you know, down home kind of president, like a little bit like Slick Willie himself in that way, because he's in all kinds of trouble, personal, private matters with his ex-wife, and he has that
Slick Willie. Sorry, I'm missing that oh, reference.
Bill Clinton.
Oh, sorry, I would have called him President Bill Clinton. I do beg your pardon.
But he does have that kind of
down home thing, kind of thing. Yeah, and the Jimmy Carter thing, the same thing. The
wink and a nod, kind of. Over familiarity. And I think I would have happily watched the two of them play off each other, him and Sterling K. Brown, because he holds, you know, his feet to the fire there. Mm. You can kind of hear him there trying to challenge him. And there's this great testiness and angst to their relationship. And I think Dan Fogelman, what we know of him is he's very good. If people have really enjoyed the runaway success of This Is Us, and what it gave people was this melodrama, sweeping melodrama, all about emotions dialed up to, you know, 10, up to 90. And you have that within this. Now, there is a twist that we can't go into.
Yes, and we're not going to go near it.
The surface, this is about these three dynamic characters. So you have, you know, and what they go through. A lot of it is about grief and sadness and separation. And you have somebody like Julianne Nicholson's character. And Julianne Nicholson is
who's playing,
a fantastic
just explain
actress.
Who she, who
She's
she is
playing
in
this
the
character
mix.
Called Sinatra. Yeah, like, that's the code name. Samantha Redmond. And
so she's kind of the head of the Secret
head
Service.
Of the Secret Service.
Certainly Sterling K. is Will,
she's behind the scenes
boss.
Political power and power player. And, you know, she could be the real commander-in-chief, quote-unquote, which is kind of why she's called Sinatra. And she is this force to be reckoned with. But she's very brittle. She's this tech mogul who's a billionaire, you know, 12 times over. But she also has this very real side to her as a mother who is going through something horrific with her children. And that all is what will get people.
Everybody is
on
humanized.
Show.
Everybody
it's the
is
human,
humanized.
The
in
characterization
this.
That Fogelman is great at. He pulls those emotional strings, and you get this feeling that you want to get to know these characters more and more.
And not the first time you and I have certainly said this, Chris, but I did say they could have got even to the assassination quicker. I felt the first episode, would you get on with it? Yeah, we know where you're heading. Would you just get there quicker, please?
Yeah.
And but maybe, and we can't get into the twist, maybe as the series progresses, does it take a twist when you're aware of what the situation is?
Well,
here?
No, it's always stalling the ball, you know.
And does it need that for the emotional truth that Jen is talking about?
I think so, maybe. There's an awful lot of delay tactics in the first episode because, again, something happens in the final minutes that gives, you know, that paints a completely different picture when it becomes a completely different show with completely different ideas. Yeah. And then it becomes about like, okay, well, we've shown you what the real setting is. And we've shown you what the real story is going to be, and now we're going to go back and we're going to explain a little bit more later on. It helps that there's great performances there. I think Sterling K. Brown, he's playing a different character, a much different character to the one that say he would have played in American Fiction or This Is Us. And what I mean by that is those roles kind of allowed him to be charismatic, to be very funny, to be quite relatable.
So reticent, here, so not available here.
I mean, he's a man
completely
who's
closed off.
He's been through an awful lot. He's quite, you know, in terms of his emotions, he's quite robotic at times. I love that Marsden, and the note that I took when I was watching Marsden was that there was a big, you know, there was a bit of a whiff of the Kennedys about
him.
He has actually played JFK before.
And so, he has that look off him.
Yeah.
There's a lazy charm to his performance, and I think we underestimate him because we see him as this Prince Charming type character, but he's so good at giving that a little bit of complexity to these outwardly handsome characters.
Yeah, I know we can't talk about the twist at the end. Am I a bit slow? If I hadn't known what the twist was, I don't think I would have known what the twist was when it happens. Did I need it spelled out a little bit more? Was I alone in that?
I think it's playing on ideas about American perfection and big ideas. And I think, you know, it kind of, as it goes on, I think episode one, you may realize that maybe not everything is as it seems. I think Dan Fogelman is really trying to put some big ideas across here that he didn't try and do maybe with This Is Us and he wants to express.
Alright, so does it succeed then as it goes through its eight episodes?
I think it's doing too much, and I would have enjoyed if it had been pared back more to the basic story, but I think there's a lot of ambition there to it, and it has to be commended for that, because as I said, it is taking those big swings that you're kind of knitting together something that's almost fantastical or paranoid, with a paranoid thriller, but with these kind of emotional characterizations as well, which is great. And I do think, you know, you're watching it for those three main performances and how they interact, and that's what keeps you there. It's
stars.
Not exactly the twist.
Okay.
It's them that keeps
stars from you, Jen.
I think three stars.
Three. And Chris?
I think Fogelman's dialogue, I love This Is Us. Yeah. I would happily rewatch the whole thing right now, and thankfully it did make Sterling K. Brown a star. But his dialogue there, it worked because that was a melodrama, that was a show all about family.
But here, the dialogue is sparse enough.
Here it's quite broad, it's quite over sentimental at times, it's a little bit convoluted. Okay. So that kind of let me down. And also, stars. Again, I'll just say about the twist, once you know what the show is about, everything else becomes kind of superfluous.
Yeah. Okay.
So that kind of bothered me. But I will stick with it for Brown and for Marsden. So three stars.
Three stars from you. Okay, let's move on then to Prime Target on Apple TV Plus, which is an espionage thriller. I think it's safe to say a Cambridge University PhD candidate, Edward Brooks, played by Leo Woodall, is on the cusp of discovering something about prime numbers. I'm so scared I'm going to say something wrong about anything in this. Something about prime numbers, or is it the Disney one, I think, was the one we had to really worry about. This is Apple Plus. But just as he's coming to completing his project, which has the capacity to decode the digital key, he is being hunted by a series of interested parties. Now, full disclosure here. When I went to college, I got very excited one morning and brought a cutting from the newspaper into my maths professor, who may well be listening tonight, to say they have now discovered there are infinitely many prime numbers of a certain form.
Oh my God. Yeah. Was this based on you?
No. Were you chasing around the world afterwards?
And also I cried when I saw and read Fermat's Last Theorem,
which was the
proof of a theorem that had not been proven for a long time.
I cried when I used to have to pull out busy at maths in primary school. So we're very different people.
So I do appreciate that perhaps I came with a different interest level in maths when I saw it's about prime numbers. Yeah. Get it on immediately.
Wow.
I think I'm alone though in this studio.
Forget the show. Just I want to know more about this actually. Yeah.
Are they trying to make maths sexy? Is this what this is about? I mean, is this a thing? I mean, you would say it was a thing. I think, you know, we had that era of filmic geniuses. Like we had, you know, Good Will Hunting, A Beautiful Mind, or even like there's a TV show, Numbers, and then even Sherlock.
Yeah,
you always
had
somebody standing in the middle distance, like calculating stuff in their head or writing down, you know, loads of like figures on a blackboard and doing maths in their head that you can't do on Countdown even. And that's my level. So they're trying to kind of, I think, harken back to this and bring those kind, but marry it to these espionage trails of another Matt Damon maybe franchise, yeah. The Bourne Identity, or even, you know, I thought when I started watching this, it was kind of like a bizarrely high-octane episode of Inspector Morse at the very start, because we have this one-day heartthrob, Leo Woodall, and he even has a kind of Matt Damon-esque hair, and he's this, your resident Clever Clogs in Cambridge, and he's named Edward, and he's stumbled upon this way to predict prime numbers, which in turn threatens to the entire, you know, security state and sends various NSA folks kind of chasing after him. And there's a lot of scenes of him, you know, brooding at a blackboard or rattling off various equations in a corduroy blazer, and it's very silly. It's completely silly. It is the kind of silly show where you have to endure a load of nonsensical acronyms and techno babble and have this suspension of disbelief is stretched to
leave the
limits.
Studio immediately. Like I got excited when they started talking about a little bit more of my about the Fibonacci series, which is how there are prime numbers make up the number of petals on the number of little dots on a daisy, the number of leaves on a stem leaf. Okay. That there's it's always a prime number. So, you know, I kind of thought this is a really clever little way in, and I did like the characters Woodall and the guy who initially he is this very old professor who unfortunately has Alzheimer's and has to hand him over to a younger man who he's not at all enamored of. And I liked all those characters. That was a nice dynamic. I'm alone again.
I think so, yeah. You could actually build an entire show around Professor Raymond Osborne, played by Joseph Mydell, who is the older fella,
lovely character, yeah.
With Alzheimer's, and he's the only man that Edwards, played by Leo Woodall, actually respects, and the only one he kind of like takes seriously. I love Leo Woodall in One Day, and I liked him an awful lot in the White Lotus. I think here he is required to play someone who is charmless, obnoxious, who looks down on everyone, who kind of criticizes others for not being as clever as he is. And so the playing the immensely unlikable character, that's intentional, but I think he might have gone a little bit too far into himself, because it's a very quiet, sort of empty, sort of lifeless performance at times. And I mean, there are some silly things to like about this. I mean, there's a scene where David Morrissey is sitting down to dinner with Edwards, and he's his actual current professor.
This is the character of Robert Malander,
who's the current professor, who's basically saying, don't be messing around with prime numbers, they're bad.
Maths is dangerous.
Yeah, they stumble upon something huge. They make this massive discovery, and Edward's looking for a pencil. And I did say to myself, if this is like Good Will Hunting, okay, a window's about to be drawn on here. Yes. But it wasn't just that, Sean. It was the tablecloth. And he takes the tablecloth with him.
Yeah, good tablecloth at that. You know, but the wife of the David Morrissey character was quite delighted that he was going to write all of this stuff down on the tablecloth. And we'll find out reasons for that later on. However, let us listen to a clip between Ed, played by Leo Woodall, and he's gone into the new professor in the hope that, you know, let's see if you're going to be good enough for me to reveal what it is that I'm trying to work on. So David Morrissey is playing the character of Robert Malander.
There's a pattern concealed inside of it. See if you can spot it.
Ed.
Take as long as you need.
We're here to talk about your research.
And you hated it, so we've moved on. Come on, 204. How can you resist?
Everyone tells me you're brilliant. I know you're brilliant. I have a 3-page letter from Ray Osborne telling me so. But this is a supervision. It's not a prize fight. How is he, by the way?
Well, he has Alzheimer's, so.
He taught me here as well, you know. So I have some idea about how close you two would have been.
There we go. That is David Morrissey and Leo Woodall as Robert and Ed, respectively, in the series Prime Target on Apple TV Plus. The way the thing develops from there on, I got very excited, by the way, that they get excited about the number 204 at a certain point.
I was right.
And I thought they'd made a mistake And then I went back and listened and they hadn't. So I was very disappointed with that. But there's a murky world going on behind this, and there's also a love story, or certainly it looks as if it's developing into a love story with a character played by Frah Fee.
Frah Fee, who is always a delightful presence. Mm. And I am
convinced. Great Irish actor,
And I should say at this point, I don't know where his character is going to end up, but I'm convinced there's a twist in that character's future.
Sure.
But he is a love interest for Edward Brooks. The only problem is that when they actually do hook up afterwards, you know, like Leo or Edward just sends him packing. He's so unlikable.
Yeah.
It's this guy who clearly has an awful lot of time for him. There's also the fact that Edward and various other mathematicians who are researching things they shouldn't are being watched by a secret agency who, you know, want to keep these guys in check, because as you said at the top, if they figure out whatever this pattern is in prime numbers that I don't understand, they will have access to all the computers in the world, and that will make them dangerous. I wanted them to explain a bit how that is, because I felt as though not only is the plot watered down, the maths is watered down, and maybe there's this thought that viewers won't be able to keep up. But I felt the same way when I was watching Oppenheimer last year, and they never really explained how you get from Killian's whiteboard to the bomb. And I just wanted a little bit more to help explain how you get there. And I wanted them to say, this is why Edward's work is dangerous. Trust
us. Well, I have a free hour at 8 o'clock.
Well, let's do it.
And we'll chat about prime numbers and the fact that there is no pattern that can be discovered.
Chaos theory. That's what we want. And I wish this was more chaotic in one way.
Right.
I found it, I wanted it to be almost sillier in a Da Vinci Code style. Like, for, I just think it may lose a lot of people when you don't have, like, say, unless, you know, Fraffy's character kind of comes back into it, or Daisy Waterstone, who's absolutely brilliant in The Drills, if she comes back into it, like, as this sparky kind of, adversary, like, she's almost a puppy dog following Edward around.
And Mrs. Borgen is here as
exactly.
well.
Like, I mean, there is all these sub characters that could
please,
be better
Jen.
Used. I didn't crack that code. For me, it was like a two.
Ridley Scott produces, he should have taken the script and directed a 2-hour feature, because this is just, it's too dull and dreary, and Leo Woodall is just misfiring, so two.
Okay, I'll talk about prime numbers during the break. And welcome back to Friday Night's Arena. Hi to the TV trio, says Dave in Donegal. Not quite paradise, but Domino's and my trusty transistor radio, a.k.a. the Owl Wireless. Well, I'm glad you're with us, Dave. And is that Domino's now, Domino's Pizza? Or are you doing prime numbers with your Domino's as well? I let it go now. I promise I've let it go. It's gone.
Prime numbers with pepperoni on the pizza.
That's an idea for a pizza. Brian and Maggie is a 2-part Channel 4 documentary which portrays the final television interview of the soon-to-be outgoing Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, played by Harriet Walker, and her friend and journalist Brian Walden, played by Steve Coogan. This interview took place in 1989, and for many, they would say that it led to the end of her leadership. It will be released on Wednesday and Thursday night of next week on Channel 4, so we're only previewing it here. We won't be giving opinions on it per se. The TV interview and the political interview, it's been at the heart of, you start, was it kind of Nixon Frost was the one that kicked it all off?
In terms of
the current interest and dramatization of the political interview.
Yeah, Scoop, Frost, Nixon. It does seem like, and there was another one on Prime Video about the Epstein interview as well.
A very royal scandal.
Yeah, it does seem like there are quite a few of them. And I think the big question you have to ask yourself going into it, if you're making one of these, is can we make something as entertaining or as thrilling as the real life interview that we're copying?
Yeah.
And most of the time, the answer is going to be no. So you should instead focus on getting a great cast who can really show us what they're made of, and also maybe hopefully strike that balance between a great performance of a real life character and an impersonation. And I think Brian and Maggie is kind of, it's on the road to that, because you've got Steve Coogan again, who has created this new phase of his career for himself, where he's basically just devoting himself to this character actor territory. I'm going to play real life characters, some of them horrible like Jimmy Savile, some of them who are still very current like Roy Keane, and then someone like Brian Walden, a journalist who maybe an awful lot of people...
He had been a politician, a Labour politician.
A Labour politician, yeah. Labour politician for 10 years who was approached by London Weekend Television in 1979, and they said, listen, we have this long form interview Sunday afternoon show that we want you to host. You would obviously have to pack in the career in politics. As this programme shows us, he did that, and for his first guest,
all of which is history, by
yeah,
the way,
all of which is history, and his first guest that he interviewed was Margaret Thatcher, and that began a 10 year friendship that then ended with their final interview in 1989.
Let's have a listen. Now, he comes in. There's a kind of a gaucheness and an innocence to him early on, because it's a political interview. He listens to what the politician says and has a debate with them. And he doesn't shout them down or interrupt them the minute they start. He lets them finish their point. So this is not going to make the production team all that happy. Let's listen to Steve Coogan as Brian Walden at an early production meeting.
Hold on. We're less than 2 days away from the biggest interview of her career, now maybe my career too, and we're wasting time on this rubbish about, what, about 30 what?
30 classic identifiable ways politicians use to avoid answering questions.
The nation is waiting to hear why the most successful partnership in modern British politics has just imploded.
Listen, they've been studying television interviews.
Yeah, well, studying. I've been doing them.
And the most common 30 tactics used to avoid answering.
Oh, Christ on a bike, my old son. I've heard them all. Minister, what about this bad thing that happened over here? Well, I think people up and down the country are more interested in is this other thing instead.
Look, the real point
look,
is...
I can't stand look. Look, I'm saying, like I'm a straight-up fellow who just wants to get to the point, when really I'm using look to pivot to an entirely different point.
Look, I'm not going into hypotheticals now.
Yeah, right, yeah. That's number 20. With regards to Thatcher...
Right, look, when... Look, you've got me doing it. But look, when it comes to the old girl, okay, I get her to talk.
You do. And her mean reply rate is higher than most of the politicians. She actually does want to talk, to debate. Her main tactic is number 4. Question, question.
All right, well, thank you. But I will get her to answer. I always get her to answer.
Steve Coogan, one of the main voice that you heard there is the journalist Brian Walden. Harriet Walter plays the character of Margaret Thatcher. And there is that balance between, and we're not reviewing, as I say, Jen, there is that balance between historical accuracy and a person, a very well-known person in the public eye, particularly Margaret Thatcher. Brian Walden, maybe not so much in this country.
Yeah.
And that's a hard balance. That's a hard balance to strike.
It is, but
Stephen Frears, by the way, is the director here.
Which Stephen Frears, as we know, like dabbles in this kind of thing, yeah, like, you know, with the Queen. And I think that's the thing is you're trying... You have to pare away it a bit because it is about this one-on-one joust at the end of the day.
And it's just about the two. It really is ultimately about the relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, because I mean...
And the events that led to the various interviews he held with
her. It's kind of also about a movement in a way, because if you look at Walden, like as a person, you know, he was not exactly this dyed-in-the-wool Labour supporter. Like he was someone who's actually uncomfortable about the notion of working class people as being dependent on benefits rather than self-made success stories like the way he envisioned himself and Margaret Thatcher. So he was somebody that you'd probably call a blue Labour supporter almost, which was kind of a new thing at that time in that way. And you can see then in the 70s that he swayed towards this rhetoric of self-interest of Thatcherism that she is selling and how it took hold of those formerly Labour voters. And through the interview, say the early interview, the first interview that they do with her, you can see that she is using this as a means to spread her message to the public. But then as the time goes on and the relationship goes on, it changes.
Very media savvy as well.
Exactly.
She knows, is this a two shot? Is this, you know, when is the camera on me?
When it moves on, you can see that she's had that training and she knows exactly
she
where
knows
to be.
Exactly where she's at. And at Channel 4, next Wednesday and Thursday, will you watch the two episodes? Have you been to?
I've watched it, and I think, you know, there's a lot in there. I can't really say, really review it, but I will say, you know, it is kind of about, you'd have time to have a 45-minute interview with a political figure, and in this day, this age of PR and pre-approved questions and spin and rhetoric and the age of the soundbite.
Interesting to see
an in-depth interview. It did happen, and you know, we even something like Rivals this year concentrated on that importance of a meeting of minds and how it changes both parties. I think it's interesting to look at, but I do think some people may find it a bit inside baseball about how you make these shows, and is that interesting to a lot of people? I don't know.
Yeah, and also it is very much it's based on the British politics of the time.
Exactly.
And if you don't know that history, you need to kind of be genned up on it,
yeah.
I would suggest in the meantime. However, we can't, as there are no stars in this one. Both episodes of Brian and Maggie will be available on Channel 4 on next Wednesday, 29th, and Thursday, the 30th of January. Yes, we are at the end of the first month of 2025. You'll find Prime Target streaming now on Apple TV Plus. All about Prime numbers, just in case you didn't pick that up earlier on. And Paradise is on Disney Plus. My thanks to Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser. Okay, on to our album reviews this evening. FKA Twigs releases her third album, Eusexua. Known for her experimental approach to music and visuals, the album blends influences from all kinds of places, techno, disco, K-pop, and creates a new and immersive soundscape described by the artist as, and I quote, a journey into euphoric self-awareness. Mogwai release The Bad Fire, 11th studio album from the Scottish band known for their emotive atmospheric soundscapes. The band draws on personal struggles and 3 decades of experience to deliver an introspective record. The title, The Bad Fire, is a Glaswegian term for hell. Never heard that before, and reflects the changes they endured during its creation. And Vermont-born folk musician Sam Omadhon releases his 8th studio album, Salt River, under Rough Trade's folk division River Lee. We will be talking to Sam Omadhon on the programme next week, but this new album, a bit like the previous stuff, is a blend of Appalachian influences, experimental sounds. Kate Brennan Harding and John Marr are with me in studio. Why don't we start with the title track? If I can get my mouse over here to the old computer screen. There we go. Why don't we start with the title track from FKA Twigs and Eusexua? Can change the course of time. Eusexua, title track from the new album from FKA Twigs. Kate Brennan Harding and John Marr are reviewers on this Friday evening. Who are we talking about, Kate, when we talk about FKA Twigs?
You're talking about Talia Deborah Barrett, and she has been releasing albums under the pseudonym FKA Twigs since 2012. FKA, people think, is formerly known as, but she just liked the letter combination. And she was called Twigs because she's a dancer and she was kind of so spindly. And there was another artist called Twigs. So FKA Twigs is who we have. But this is her third studio album. Now, she's released lots and lots of sort of collaborative playlists and collaborative mixtapes and all that sort of stuff. And this album here has come in terms of, from her perspective, she spent some time recording The Crow, or filming The Crow, the updated version of The Crow in Prague. So she spent a lot of time in techno clubs there. And the theme around this is kind of that techno journey and that space, that liminal space when you're dancing and happy and present in the moment.
Yeah, and that term, the album title, Eusexua, is a term she has coined herself, John, I believe.
It is indeed. She's done a George Bernard Shaw on it. Let me read the description here, because it's a transcendental state of euphoria that comes with sex, connection, dancing, meditation, and so on. As Kate says, dancing and clubs are fundamental to this, but there's a lot of carnal ideas as well at the fore. But she seems to be playing with both the intimacy of connection, but also the euphoria that comes of being on a dance floor in a fantastic club.
But it also would be wrong to think that, and now all the dance fans will hate me, this is more than just a dance record.
Oh yeah,
can I say that without alienating half the nation?
Absolutely. I think you've got Marius de Vries, the veteran producer, working on this, and he's worked with people like Bjork and Massive Attack. And those are acts that actually I'm thinking of when I'm listening to this album, because there's an awful lot happening here. For sure, techno is maybe the building blocks or the central foundation of this. but there's some fantastic textured layer music going on too, isn't there?
I think something that's really interesting is techno. When somebody is listening to this now and they hear techno, they're probably going to be thinking about this incredibly pulsating, kind of visceral beat. And actually, techno is much more than that. And it's, you know, it's texturized, it's an experience. And what she's done, I feel, is kind of, you're kind of in a sort of a fever dream with this, because she's kind of, the beats are never over the top and overpowering.
Yeah.
You know, and it is.
They're there, but they're always there, and the rhythms are very clear, but they're subtle.
Yeah, they kind of wrap around you and envelop you. You're in that club with her. You know, you're in that space with her, or you're in that space with yourself. So I wouldn't allow the term techno put you off listening to this album.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying it's more than just a dance record. It's precisely that there's a lot more going on.
I mean, I think that cliche about an album for both your feet and the heart is absolutely the case here. I mean, you can enjoy this in a club with 1,000 other people, but also in headphones alone at night particularly.
All right, let's have a listen to a second track. This is called Girl Feels Good.
I fear the man who finds himself lost. And tell him, you know, she feels pretty. A girl feels good. And what goes round and you love her, but allowed to keep the devil down when a girl feels good.
Girl feels good. And the beat does begin to kick in a little bit there, but that's kind of as banger as it gets probably across this album.
No, there is definitely some more pulsating kind of songs and more kind of songs that like will lead you in gently, and 2 minutes in suddenly you're in the drop of a club. But I love that song, Girl Feels Good. I was saying when we were just listening there to it, it reminds me of Madonna, Ray of Light era, especially with her vocals, and she's got such an amazing range, but it's also got that trippy kind of underworld orbital dancescape to it as well. Everything about this album is immersive, and everything about it is around sort of experiencing joy and empowerment. And Girl Feels Good, she has said, it's about like when a girl feels good, everything is great in the world for her. And as a woman, I can totally appreciate that.
All right. Stars from you on this one, first of all, Kate.
This is an absolute masterpiece. It's 4.5 out of 5 for me.
Solid 4.5 out of 5 from you. What are you saying, John?
I think it's a fantastic album. There's one or two tracks, a track like Childlike Thing, which I didn't like. It features Northwest, which is Kanye West and Kim Kardashian's daughter. But on the whole, it's very, very good. 4 stars. From me.
4 stars from you. Okay, let us move on to Mogwai then, and an album called The Bad Fire, which, as I said earlier, is the Glaswegian slang term, or don't frighten your kids term, for hell, I guess. And here is a track from the album called Fanzine Made of Flesh. That's a Mogwai and a little flavour of Fanzine Made of Flesh from the new album, which is called The Bad Fire. Very popular band, very popular Scottish band, John. But I think in recent times there have been difficulties in personal lives here, which they say are very much present in this album.
Yeah, Barry Burns, one of the founders of the band, his daughter required bone marrow surgery, so a very difficult time for them. And that came on the back of an album that did surprisingly well in Britain, like they stepped out of the margins. Now,
is that As Love As The Love Continues, was that the one that the last, was that yeah. the last album? Yeah, yeah.
And I suppose there's a sense they've talked about the travails, the familial stuff, kind of I suppose inspiring them to make music that's, because there was a happy ending, his child is fine now, so it's, there's a positivity running through this album. I think myself and Kate will disagree on this. The track we just heard I actually love, because it reminds me of people like My Bloody Valentine and also Granddaddy with that synth line coming through, which that's, I found absolutely fantastic.
That's exactly why, because those are bands I'm not a fan of.
Ah, okay.
And that's the one song on the album that I just wasn't kind of clicking in with. I think it's interesting as well. There's such a sense of sadness can be evoked through the songs. And you feel it because there's very little vocals. There's always very little vocals.
Yeah, very few lyrics here.
Or they're put through wordlets or kind of.
But vocal I did have the question, and again, you know, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy what he has had to go through with his daughter, and I'm delighted, and everybody would be delighted that she's at the other end of that. But I wonder to what extent, in this album in particular, is that projected out for the listener? Maybe it would be better live, but I wondered, you know. I kind of find myself going, these songs are melding into one another. See, I don't know the story that's been told to me.
Well, I guess the thing is that this is an atmospheric band. They're 11 albums in, they're 30 years in their career. They're really solidly every 2 years. And the whole point of Mogwai, from what I can see, I've seen them live twice, and it is that immersive thing where what you're feeling to the song is what you're feeling. They're not trying to convey or make you understand the storyline. Yeah. Does that make sense? But,
it does.
What I would say is that there's an awful lot of variation on this album, but I think over the course of their career, they're doing much of the same kind of thing. They're not reinventing their own wheel. And other bands get slammed for that, but there's a lot of...
Yeah, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
They don't.
But yeah, that's a quick listen to a little bit of Lion Rumpus and then we get Stars. Just a little favourite, Lion Rumpus there, which is the final track on the Mogwai album, and I would say one of the slightly different ones, although John Maher, I know you're saying to me, they're all very different, John, and maybe I need a couple of listens to it to kind of hear the subtleties. Stars from you on this one, first of all, Kate?
Well, I think they're a cult classic band. They're not rewriting anything that their sound, but you can rely on them to deliver a completely immersive experience. It's 4 out of 5 from me, but give them a chance. Listen to this a few times.
Yeah, okay. John?
It's 4 from me as well, and I think there are tracks here like High Chaos that will sound epic live. I think it's really worth spending time with.
Yeah, I wondered about the live aspect for sure in these, because you know it's a big guitar, big band sound. You can see how it would fill a stadium,
and it grows and
and you wouldn't care about the fact that you can't hear lyrics. It's not about that.
Just like you know, Sigur Rós isn't about lyrics either, and it's same idea here.
Let's move on to album. Did I get stars from both of you? Yes.
Yep.
2 4s. Yep. Let's move on to Sam Amadon then and Salt River. And here is a track called I'm On My Journey Home.
Come and go with me, oh come and
Sam Amadon, and I'm on my journey home. One of the songs on his new album, Salt River. As I said, we're hoping to speak with him next week, and we'll listen to more of the album at that point. Sam Amadon, the background there, Vermont, folk singer parents, you can hear the Appalachian kind of style, and very much fits in with an Irish style of song delivery as well. He was part of the Nobodaddy tour with Chuck Dowsa at the end of last year. He was on stage for all of that. I must say, I was enamoured of this album very quickly.
Oh, that's a really good thing. I think as well, he's really interesting. I have to admit, I had never come across Sam Amadon before, which I believe is quite shocking for most people. I am really pleasantly surprised by my listens through this album. It's very different in terms of, you've just heard something there that's like combining Appalachian sounds and folk sounds. But his when I'm reading up about him, it's all about his interpretations and reinterpretations of old folk, old ballad, and then he filters it through this amazing jazz sound.
Yeah, like, there's a track called Tavern where, you know, it goes on to this saxophone and really kind of synthy thing
by
the end.
I don't know how many times I replayed that song Tavern, because 1 minute and 30 seconds in, it's completely transformed into a different song. I really enjoyed as well, like, he's taken the likes of Lou Reed's song Big Sky, he's taken Yoko Ono, and he has reinterpreted. And he's talked as well about, you know, his ideas in life around music are just looking for simple truths in humanity.
Yeah, and John, it is interesting that somebody like Sam Amadon does take that breadth of music, Yoko Ono, Lou Reed, as Kate was saying, and again, a more traditional folk style. But I don't think you're as enamoured of it as either Kate or I.
I'm not as much. I think there are some very fine moments on it, and it is worth pointing out that I think this is a three-pronged affair. Percussionist Philippe Melanson, multi-instrumentalist Sam Gendel are very much part of this as well.
Gendel is the saxophone player, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Producer, yeah.
And again, they're bringing the jazz elements into the trad here. I'm quite familiar with his work. You know, he's very prolific. It just didn't do as much for me, some of the song choices. While that cliche of more admiring than loving in terms of what he did, I think he does reinvent stuff. And I did like what he did with that Lou Reed song, Big Sky. I thought that was very interesting. His vocal here, it's quite pared back. Yeah. I just wasn't as excited, I think, as both of you.
Do you know what was really interesting about Big Sky, though, was he only read the lyrics in a book and he had never heard the song.
Oh, really? Maybe not a bad thing,
exactly,
perhaps.
Exactly, and I thought that was fascinating.
Well, if you're going to reinterpret a song, that's a really good start.
It's
great
point, isn't it? He went and then listened to it, to Lou Reed's version, and was like, whoa. And he just, because what he thought was this really beautiful lyrical ability.
Was so something else.
It's completely making something new and not a cover, you know? It's beautiful.
Starting me on this one, John?
It's a solid three for me.
Solid three. What are you saying, Kate?
Well, I'm actually agreeing. I'm saying 3 out of 5 for me, but I would imagine that people who are big fans of his, who know his work, will be hyped up to give it more.
We might. Sam Amadon and Salt River, the third of our 3 albums this evening. And as I say, we will be talking to him next week. In fact, he is performing at the Gate Theatre tomorrow evening. I'm sure if you check out gatetheatre.ie, not sure if there are still tickets available, and he'll be with us on the programme next week. We also spoke about Mogwai, The Bad Fire, and You Sexua from FKA Twigs. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you on Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. And to all of you struggling still with the after effects of the storm, hope that all of that passes soon and the things get back to normal for you. But obviously stay with us here. Lots of great music to take you through the next couple of hours here on RTE Radio 1. Because Ray Cuddihy, I do believe, will be with you after the 8 o'clock news. Back with you Monday at 7.